Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
In many ways, Republican Peter Roskam was a poster child for the 2018 election. A solidly conservative congressman from suburban Chicago, he was swept away in the Democratic wave. Roskam spent the winter as a fellow at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, reflecting on his experiences in Congress and the shifting landscape of American politics in the era of Trump. We sat down and had a lively conversation about all of it recently, and here it is. Peter Roskam, good to see you. Thank you for being here, and thank you for being a fellow at the Institute of Politics this winter. You were a great presence around here.
I have thoroughly enjoyed it. And just quickly, when people ask me about being here, and a lot of people are concerned about the future of our country, and I say, I've seen a glimpse of it. These kids are bright and interesting and respectful and charming, and I've come away invigorated from this experience.
Yeah,
which
is good, because campuses are not by nature conservative. At least this campus is that we have we run the gamut here, mm-hmm. but it probably, I think it's fair to say it trends more liberal than conservative, and it's good to have someone from a right perspective come and make and come away with that kind of experience.
Yeah, no question. And it's been interesting to talk to conservative kids, and they'll come in and kind of give me a secret handshake
yes.
during office hours. And then progressive kids will come
in. This is a podcast. Maybe you can show me. Nobody will know
what that looks like. Yeah. But the progressive kids have come in, and there is an interesting juxtaposition or confluence of people who are concerned on both ends of the spectrum about a lot of things that they're hearing in terms of tone and disposition. And I was able to speak in some cases directly to that. And the title of my seminar for these past several weeks is "So You Think Congress is Broken?" And I've been bringing to the attention of the students some design features by the founders as a restraining influence for power, which is interesting. And sometimes it's up against a cultural overlay where we have an expectation of the ease with which things get done, instant gratification. And when you start to look at these systems of governance in that fashion, I think it can be very encouraging.
Yeah, well, that is true. I think you and I have had this offline discussion about this, but you know, one of my concerns is that the pace of change today is so warp speed because of technology that keeps churning at faster and faster rates, and so change is coming at us at a pace and a rate that we have rarely seen, and that's brought big economic disruption, social disruptions, migrations, and so on. All of that, I think, is challenging every liberal democracy, including ours, and because we have these systems that are set up to move slowly when there's division. And so you see government moving slowly, gridlock. You know, and we can get into later. I know you know there are you point to examples where that isn't the case. But on big things, it's very hard to get stuff done. And there is an impatience and arrest of this. I think Donald Trump is a reflection of that. His election really was a reaction on the part of those who voted for him to their frustrations with government. But we'll get to that. I want to just go back to your story and your family, the Roskams, and your dad, Verlin Swede.
Swede Roskam.
Yeah. I guess the name implies something.
No, here's the joke of the name. So Roskam is a Dutch name. It means horse brush. So I'm sure that we were peasant stable hands in generations past. But my father had white blonde hair as a kid, and he came from a Swedish part of his town, and they said, here comes the Swede, here comes Swede, and it stuck. And if you've got a name like Verlin, you're pretty quick to adopt
yeah,
something.
Yeah, Swede is good.
It's
yeah.
pretty good
so
stuff.
So tell me about where the
interesting
family
story.
From.
So he, my dad grew up in Iowa, and there was an Iowa farm couple.
But where did his family come from?
So, I mean, they're Dutch German folks mm-hmm. came over in the mid 1800s.
And settled in Iowa?
Yeah, settled in Minnesota and in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So
pretty common.
Yeah, that's
story.
Right. That's right. Yeah. What was interesting about my dad in particular was there was an Iowa farm couple named Roy and Ella Jenkins, and they lost their son George Jenkins in the Normandy invasion, and they decided to honor his memory, and through a wild set of circumstances that I believe was providential, they ended up choosing my dad, and they took him from a really tough background.
Well, when you say tough background, what do you mean?
What I mean is his mother was married 5 times, and this mm-hmm. is, you know, in the 30s and 40s, which you can imagine sort of the scandal of that, mm-hmm. and modest economic background and so forth. But he was a scrappy kid, and he earned enough money to go to Wentworth Military Academy, paid his own way, in Lexington, Missouri, as a junior in high school. Hmm. And he couldn't afford to go back his senior year. Mr. and Mrs. Jenkins heard about it. And David, they paid his tuition, room, board, books, fees, spending money. They bought him this class ring that I'm wearing today, yeah. and they changed his life. And he was aware of that. So my dad had 2 great gifts. One was a gift of gratitude, and the other was a gift of generosity. And to be raised by somebody like that is a gift to me.
Yeah.
So,
did he keep in touch with the Jenkins?
Throughout. Now, they passed away before any of us kids were born, but he was very, very attentive to them.
He took so much inspiration from that story that he enlisted himself.
Right. He went into the U.S. Army. He was a young company commander over in Korea. Had met my mother at Knox College in Galesburg.
Yeah, yeah.
And went into business, worked for a Chicago-based manufacturer, the Oil Dry Corporation of America, here in Chicago in the Wrigley Building, a great company for 45 years or so, and sort of an iconic salesman. And then ultimately had a real desire to try and pay back what Mr. and Mrs. Jenkins had done. And so he and a group of businessmen came up with an idea of converting excess inventory donations from corporations, trading that with colleges for tuition scholarships for disadvantaged kids. And just kind of to put a point on this, my dad passed away 4 years ago. A couple years ago, my mother and I were invited to represent him at an event, basically, or to participate in an event that this organization that he had founded, Educational Assistance Limited, had. And they were celebrating 15,000 kids that they'd helped. Yeah. And so the hero of the story, the heroes are Mr. and Mrs. Jenkins.
Yeah.
And the ripple effect of that generosity.
It is a great story. You grew up in the western suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
Always interested in politics.
So I was one of those kids in fourth grade in Miss Anderson's class that couldn't get enough of the state of Illinois section. And then in eighth grade in Mrs. Frelick's class.
How many of those kids were there?
I think I was the only one. I loved that stuff and just kept drawn to it. And my family was not political. I mean, my parents voted and were typical suburban Republicans. But it's not like we were talking about the great weighty issues of our day around the dinner table or anything. But I just found myself getting drawn to it and drawn to it over a period of time.
And you went to University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
You ended up interning on Capitol Hill.
I ended up knocking on the doors, and I got a job with Tom DeLay back before he was the majority leader.
This was after you left U of I?
So I went to U of I, went to Chicago Kent Law School, hated it, blew it off, moved to the Virgin Islands, taught high school down there in St. Thomas, and then moved to D.C.
How'd you make that decision? Listen, I mean, I'm not in any way
you're not criticizing
your judgment. I might ask you why you came back, but that's a different thing.
So I was working for this federal judge in the Northern District of Indiana. It was a good opportunity, good judge, but I was very restless and didn't really like it, and ended up going to the Glen Ellyn Public Library. And I got
so you
the
did
names.
Finish the law school.
Ultimately, I finished. Mm-hmm. I got the names and addresses of 200 English-speaking schools around the world, and I sent them a cover letter in which I sounded amazing, by the way. And I got a stack of rejection letters back. You can imagine this.
So not amazing enough.
Not amazing enough, yeah. But one phone call. Mrs. Brady from St. Thomas called me up, and I got she got me on the phone, and 2 weeks later, I was down teaching, and it was really, really quite a fun time, and I'm very nostalgic.
What kind of kids were you teaching?
So these were, this was a little Episcopal school, All Saints School, about 400 kids at the time, kindergarten through 12th grade. I think I was 22 or 23, and my oldest kids were 17, so you can imagine this. But they were bright, a wide range of kids, most of them born and raised in on the island, some from the Indian diaspora, some kids from the States whose parents had chucked it and were living on sailboats. And what was there, what I came to reflect and appreciate was the interracial warmth there and the familiarity and the ease with which people were interacting, which is very different than coming from Chicago, mm-hmm. which has, you know, pretty clear lines and so forth. Yeah, that's
segregated.
Right.
Segregated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, are you Episcopalian?
I'm sort of a junior varsity Episcopalian. I guess that's the best way to describe me. I'm not much of a denominationalist. I believe in the divinity of Jesus and follow him, and that manifests itself in a lot of different ways.
And this was important in your home.
This is very important in my home. Just without question, my parents grew up. They both had that personal faith in Christ, and they invited us as children to participate with them in that. And each of my siblings has made that our own.
Mm-hmm. We'll get back to this because obviously it enters into how you view some public issues and some of these debates. So you went to Washington.
Went to D.C.
And why did you decide to do that?
That therein the restlessness. I had this vague idea of having a desire to get involved in public service.
You did run for office in school, right?
I did, and I lost by one vote. Very good experience.
Yeah.
I remember a student I went to high school with, I bumped into her on the quad, and I said, I need your vote. And she said, well, I'm just not into that. And I let her walk away. Never did I underestimate the power of
you know,
a single
I had
vote.
This interesting conversation with Nancy Pelosi, and I said, well, what'd you learn from growing up as the daughter of, you know, a party leader, a mayor, a ward leader, and so on? She said that I learned how to count.
Yeah.
She said, and I learned that yes means yes. The I hear you, that kind of stuff, that's not a yes.
Yeah, that's right. So, I told the students this week, I said, if you ever hear the phrase in a legislative body, I don't have a problem with that, you're dead. It's over. Keep working it.
You were a whip, so you must... You were a vote counter.
I was a vote counter at a time when it was getting increasingly difficult to count Republican votes. Uh-huh. And that's, you know, the whole Tea Party phenomenon had come along, and the game board had flipped in a lot of ways in terms of legislative expectations on the Republican side of things.
We'll get back to that. So you knocked on a door, and there was a freshman from Texas.
Freshman from Texas in 1234 in the Longworth building, and his His name was Tom DeLay, and I interviewed with him, and he ended up hiring me. And I got a, I joined his staff about 9 months into his first term, and spent a year there, and did typical stuff: legislative correspondent, legislative assistant, and then an opportunity opened up in the office of my predecessor, Henry Hyde. And
your predecessor when you went to Congress,
that's
but he
right.
was an institution in
he was
Illinois.
An institution by then,
yeah.
for sure. And and an institution
politics.
fairly quickly on the life issue, and then ultimately he carved out a reputation that was very strong in all things foreign affairs, and came to chair the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Judiciary Committee, particularly during
big,
the Clinton
colorful
impeachment.
Figure.
Yeah, big personality. And I will say this of Henry. He was the same to his staff as he was to others. There was no, you and I have encountered a lot of people that can put on a public face and yet are very different people to their staff. Henry and DeLay, both of these guys were very generous to their staffs and magnanimous towards us.
I had interactions with him when I was a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and he was always a fun quote. You know,
he had a turn of a phrase and just a very quick and easy way about him that there was a winsomeness, I think, that and there was it was a generational blessing to me in that I came to Congress, and it's nice to succeed somebody who everybody liked. So when you're trying to get on a particular committee, they're like, oh, he's Henry's guy. Put him on the committee. And
yeah.
You're the
it's
beneficiary
interesting because he was well-liked, and he was well-liked across the aisle. And yet he was the author of some pretty provocative pieces of legislation, including the Hyde Amendment,
right.
which is provocative to this day, which bans the use of federal dollars for abortion services.
Yeah, that's right. So he was a person of great consequence, and I think he is a wonderful example to me of the type of disposition that we need in public life. In other words, people bringing a perspective and an urgency and an authenticity to what they're talking about, but then an ease with which people can interact with him. So at his funeral, many friends across the aisle came to speak at his funeral and to speak about these interpersonal relationships that they had with him.
It's interesting because just in the last week or so, you know, now as Vice President Biden is kind of torquing up
mm-hmm.
what is apparently a run for president. He, by the time this podcast airs, he may have mm-hmm. announced his decision. But, you know, he spoke at Jesse Helms' funeral and at Fritz Hollings, I mm-hmm. think, as well. And there's disconsternation about that because they were segregationists mm-hmm. and at one time. And but he came from that Joe Biden came to the Congress in the 1970s, you know, when Hyde and others
right.
were there and across the rotunda, of course. But there was a different ethos, a different atmosphere in the Congress at that time.
You know, it's interesting. One of the people that I invited to speak at the seminar here at the IOP is Congressman David Price, Democrat from North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So David and I had dinner the night before, and we were talking about emerging democracies and work that we had done in Congress on this issue. But at the dinner, I said, David, as important as any subject matter that we're going to be talking about is what you and I are going to model before these students tomorrow. And what they're going to see is two people who not just tolerate one another, but enjoy one another and respect one another and can find common ground to work together. And I am of the view that there is much more of that is happening much more frequently than that gets people's attention, number one. And when people hear about it, when the general public hears about it, they are greatly encouraged by it. There's almost a palpable sense of relief when I've been able to give examples of this to go and say, look, at a time when you think that the Ways and Means Committee is just clashing beyond belief, here's an example of where people are working together, but it's just not getting the attention that other things are.
But it's harder, don't you think? I mean, the environment is such that, you know, within each party, the incentive for kind of cooperation or at least touting it is reduced. Maybe less so in your district, because you had one of the competitive districts, suburban districts that were battlegrounds
right.
in 2000. But so many of these districts aren't competitive. In so many of these districts, the only thing you have to worry about is that someone will primary you.
Yep.
That creates a different dynamic.
That does create a different dynamic. If you're a Republican and you're always looking over your right shoulder, and if you're a Democrat, if you're always looking over your left shoulder, it becomes troublesome. So in the same way that there are two views of the economy, and maybe we'll end up talking about this later, but these two views of the economy, zero-sum game in one sense and growth versus another, those are being litigated right now. Here's where our politics is, though. Our politics are such that it's all zero-sum game right now. So to your point, if you win, I lose in our current politic, and we tend to reward sort of this spiking of the football and over-characterization. You said something, I think, a minute ago, and it was about incentives. And I think part of the challenge for you and I and people who take this public square so seriously, the challenge is, how do we realign incentives so that people are incentivized to work together?
That's kind of up to voters in a way. You know, I just had this discussion with a reporter who called me from Britain, because they're now, you know, it's like welcome to gridlock.
Yeah.
And around this Brexit issue. Mm-hmm. And no, that's exactly what I said. You know, the incentives are misaligned, and there is no real incentive right now for obvious incentive in our politics for compromise, for bipartisanship.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if that doesn't change, it's going to be very hard to get to the point where big things can get done.
Yeah, and look, I think that there's something that happens to people who enter in and are trying to fix things, and that is, the process of trying to get something done can change them and shape them. So here's a historic example. Thomas Jefferson writes the Declaration of Independence, we all know, in 1776. And he's obviously no stranger to the vision of the Revolution, the big picture. What's interesting is 14 years later, so you can imagine 14 years of sort of grinding, Jefferson writes a letter to a guy named Charles Clay, who is a pastor. And I'll give you three lines from this letter, and I've checked it out. This is not a manipulation or out of context. Jefferson wrote, "The ground of liberty is to be gained by inches. We must be content with what we can get from time to time and eternally press forward for what is yet to get. It takes time to persuade men even to do what is for their own good." And I think therein lies a big part of the challenge. Jefferson was making a very strong argument there for incremental change. Take a step. And over a period of time, it creates more progress, depending on where you want to go.
And that is absolutely true. This gets back to my point before about the mismatch between the nature of the times in which we live
yeah.
and the nature of democratic government. Democratic government is designed to move slowly, and particularly when we're divided, and change does come incrementally, especially in a big, diverse country.
Yeah.
But the demand for action is much greater now. And some of it is, I think, the natural byproduct of all of these big disruptions that change has brought. Some of it is, you mentioned immediate gratification. We are on the razor's edge all the time now because of our media habits, and
yeah.
you know, you're being riled up every moment.
Yeah.
You pick up your phone and you see some story, or you see some tweet, or you see, and you know, people are restive, and so it's going to take real wisdom to navigate this. And I will say, I don't want to leap into the Trump discussion. You had some experience with him. I want to talk about that. But it is very easy to exploit that sense of aggrievement and that
yeah.
sense of anxiety. It takes real leadership to navigate it responsibly. And one of my concerns is he's very, very good at exploiting the agreement. I think it's it's the center of his political project, you mm-hmm. know, and that I think is concerning. But we'll get back to that. You don't need to offer any rebuttal. We'll get back to that. Tom DeLay, the guy you work mm-hmm. for, was also a very provocative guy. And when you talk about this, you know, politics changed, and you were around the Congress around the time when it started to change. Mm-hmm. There was this revolt against,
leadership.
Bob Michael, who was the Republican leader in the House from Peoria, yeah. Illinois,
an iconic figure,
was a very genial guy. Mm-hmm. Used to drive home to Illinois with Dan Rostenkowski,
right.
A Democrat, and represented a time when, you know, people fought hard and then took what they could get. And
yeah.
moved on. And then the Gingrich Revolution came. Mm-hmm. And Newt was more of a zero-sum guy. You win,
right.
we lose kind of guy. And Tom DeLay was like in
right
the trenches
there.
Of
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. So I think that there was a... my understanding of that time was the restlessness was from the Republican Young Turks, basically, that were saying, hey, you're not bringing your game here. And they were very critical of their leadership and were willing to come in and essentially flip the game board and say, we're not going to play your old game. And the irony is they were setting up a pattern that has now manifested itself in a lot of different ways. The new group of progressives who shown up are basically saying, we're not playing your game. The Tea Party members who showed up in 2010 were saying, we're not playing your game. And I would argue that there's a brightness, David, even to that, in that it has this effect of releasing a valve in this country, a pressure valve, right out, and it is the way in which democracies tend to respond.
That is of benefit if the valve stops spewing steam at some
mm-hmm.
point,
mm-hmm.
and the problem is the steam keeps coming. But getting back to that era, the precipitous for that rebellion was the budget of 1990 when President Bush,
mm-hmm.
H.W. Bush, agreed to a budget balancing package that included higher taxes.
Right.
And he had said, read my lips, no new taxes. I was with Jeb Bush the other day doing my Axe Files CNN show, and he pointed out, and he's right, that that tax bill and that budget that they developed really laid the groundwork for a economic turnaround. And he has some validity to that.
Yeah.
But the point was that budget was not simply taxes. There were capitulations
mm-hmm.
on both sides. There were compromises
mm-hmm.
on both sides. And so isn't that what we were just talking about? Isn't that what the legislative process is supposed to be in a
yeah.
democracy?
Yeah, it is. And there's consequences to that. So nobody says that you get to do this into perpetuity. And nobody says that you're not the subject of discipline or a rough justice by your constituents. And don't I know that, having gone through, you know, the election that I just went through. But in the great scheme of things, the system works. And so put this into a larger context of the rise of authoritarianism around the world and the restlessness that many constituents feel because they are not feeling heard by the folks that are mm-hmm. purported to represent them. And then who comes over the hilltop? The strong man comes over the
right.
hilltop and says, hey, I'm going to...
That's what we're seeing.
I can eclipse all this sort of stuff. And let me just make one observation. There's this odd comparison between Donald Trump and Barack Obama. And you didn't roll your eyes, but you would. I know you're rolling your eyes in your head. But
I'm all ears, man. I'll reserve the eye rolling for the.
Here's the odd comparison between these two very different men. They both came based on massive personalities. Both of them came to office. The Obama personality phenomenon we had not seen before in 2008. You were right in the middle of that, only to be succeeded by Trump's personality. Now, very different personalities, but massive personalities brought both of those men into office. Now, here's what's interesting: neither of their personalities can swamp the boat. Neither of those men were able to come in and just dispatch and be dismissive of co-equal branches of government. The Obama administration had to wrestle with Congress and the courts. The Trump administration has to wrestle with Congress and the courts. And therein lies the brilliance of the founders. I mean, they absolutely, even though they may not have been able to anticipate the whole thing, they created a system that is now still the envy of the world. It is a remarkable system that we
yeah,
have.
No, that's I'm not rolling my eyes at that point. I think that's an important point. We can get back to that because you actually know Barack Obama mm-hmm. in a way that few people do.
Mm-hmm.
After your work in the Congress, you came back, you ran for the legislature.
Right.
And you served in the Illinois House.
Right.
And then you ran for Congress and lost.
Right.
And you were appointed to fill a vacancy in the state Senate, and you served with Barack Obama
Senate. We served together for 4 years. And what was interesting about
that— You were on the Judiciary Committee together.
Right. And here's the thing. You know, you look at the Judiciary Committees in the U.S. Congress, and they're the most partisan committees. The Judiciary Committee in the Illinois Senate was the least partisan committee because all of us were lawyers, and— all of our colleagues hated us because we were all lawyers. And but what was interesting is then Senator Obama and I were able to work together on some interesting death penalty reforms, for example. And this is a way that you're supposed to approach these things. He was an abolitionist as it relates to the death penalty. I was not an abolitionist, but both of us recognized there were some serious issues with the implementation of the death penalty here. And some very—
Illinois, in fact, 13 people were on death row through DNA evidence were found to be not guilty of the crime
for which
they were accused.
That's right. So very serious things were going on. And so we were able to come together and come up with some compromise process. He pushed basically the ACLU and the defense bar. He pushed them. I pushed the police and the prosecutors. Together, we were able to push everybody into agreeing to some compromises. It overwhelmingly passed the legislature. It was signed into law. And it's good stuff. And so I think those are attributes that I think that we need more of. He didn't change my mind. I didn't change his mind. We weren't looking to change each other's minds, but we were looking to find common ground. Another word that is often disparaged is compromised. So, okay, look at it in the most favorable light and call it common ground. Where can we agree? And there's many times a lot of things that people can agree on.
You and I were talking a few days ago about the difference between the state legislature and Washington in this context.
The legislature is a small place, and you're physically present with one another. So you and I are seated 4 feet away from each other in terms of a table today, and there are things, there's a restraining influence that comes as a result of just personal relationship, as opposed to 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives. I served out there for 12 years. There are people who were in Congress that sometimes I would see and I would think, are they a member of, or was that the librarian in high school? You know what I mean?
You're supposed to be wearing those little pins, you know?
Yeah, most of them are wearing the pins. But my point is, 59 members in the Illinois Senate, you're physically present for hours and hours. You're operating as a committee of the whole. You're amending bills on the floor. Importantly, your interactions our actual conversations. You're speaking to one another and not just to a camera. And so the dynamic is different.
The other element is that Springfield is a relatively small town.
Not much to
do. Not a lot to do. So you guys hung around together.
Yeah,
that's right. You saw each other in restaurants. You saw each other maybe even occasionally in a tavern.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, Obama famously had his poker game
once a week. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
In fact, one of the players in his poker game was Senator Brady, who's now the
Republican
leader in the Senate. So when you worked with Barack Obama in the Senate, what were your impressions of him?
Look, he was a good abstract thinker, and he was able to get to an issue fairly quickly. As I've told other friends, I knew Barack Obama before he was born in Bethlehem. But look, there would be times when there would be an issue, for example, and everyone was sort of, you know, kind of cutting around the edges. And he'd say, you know what, isn't this really the issue that we're dealing with?
Yeah.
And it turns out that was really the issue, and kind of an ease with which he was able to put his finger on what we actually had to deal with.
And did you were you surprised at the evolution of his political career?
Oh, I was surprised. I mean, this is not to be a criticism of him, but you never think that someone that you're interacting with on a daily basis is going to go on to be president of the United States within. A very
four years after leaving the Illinois Senate,
right?
He was
president of the United States.
Well, it was. Let's see, he left the Senate in 2004. Yeah, 4 years later. Yeah.
Right. So that's a big jump from representing Hyde Park to representing the whole country in 48 months. And so, did I see
in
that
fairness,
coming?
He represented South Shore and a few other neighborhoods too, Kenwood.
but no, did I see that coming? I did not see that coming.
You got elected to the Congress in 2006. Interest of full disclosure, I worked for your opponent when I was still active.
I recall that.
Tammy Duckworth. Well, you can be magnanimous about it because you won, of course.
There you go.
It was a very, very hard-fought race.
Yeah.
Worked out fine for both of you.
Yeah, it did.
She ended up in
She's
a good spot.
She's doing all right.
Yeah, now senator from Illinois. But when Obama got elected president, you must have been a pretty important person in your caucus because you actually knew him. You must have been like the Sherpa.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that, and I think some of that is there were people that were looking to me in terms of translation. I think that those things are difficult to translate. So I had a perspective on Senator Obama, with whom I served in the Illinois Senate, but now we're dealing with a different figure. And even though it was not that long in terms of time, a lot had happened in 48 months. And in terms of his disposition and his trajectory and so forth. And one of my criticisms of him as president was that I think he would have been better off to go back to that, back to some of those characteristics, and I didn't see that type
characteristics
of
characteristics that you saw in the Senate.
Yeah. Taking yes for an answer, for example.
You know, so I was there for the first couple of years.
Yeah.
And let me just say, share my perspective on that. There was a sense that he had won a big election. Democrats had won two consecutive legislative elections in which the House was now overwhelmingly Democratic. The Senate was overwhelmingly Democratic. The Senate, ultimately there were 60 senators for a while, Democratic senators. And the reaction that I saw on your side was, We're in a world of hurt here. We're in this economic crisis. He's going to have to make a bunch of really difficult decisions. And our way back to majorities is not to be partners with him in making these tough decisions. And Mitch McConnell virtually said that. I mean, he did an interview with the New York Times that is seared in my brain from January of 2010, in which he said, "We weren't going to." He said, "If we cooperated, it would have signified that he had figured things out, and we just weren't going to give him that." And you know, I will tell you, Peter, that we invited people. I was party to conversations where Republicans were in the White House on the Affordable Care Act, and said, I could support this, but only if you get 10 others, because, you know, policy of our caucus is
right.
We're not for this. And he waited 6 months because Max Baucus, who was chairman of the Finance Committee, thought, we can get some Republicans on board for this, so just give me some time. And 6 months passed, and tons of conversation,
right,
including, you know, back and forth on what could be changed. So, you know, this is a place where I think politics intrude. I'm not saying that he couldn't have done more, but I'm saying that I think there was a policy that cooperation was not necessarily helpful in terms of getting back the seats that were lost.
So I understand completely what you've just said. I think there is and hindsight is always 20/20. I think there was an opportunity on the first stimulus bill, for example, right out of the gate, to load that up as a real infrastructure bill. The classic, the typical understanding of infrastructure, roads, bridges, and so forth. And I am of the view that about 100 Republicans would have voted for that. I think that would have changed the disposition and sort of the trajectory of the president's domestic agenda moving forward. And I think in that case, success would have begat success. Now, as quickly as I point that out, I'm also quick to point out that the Republican mistake, in my view, when I was in Congress, was we never offered an alternative to the Affordable Care Act. It was a strategic mistake. When President Obama was in office, we should have, and we were in the majority in Congress, we should have moved through and created that. And because there's alternatives, the big challenge was there's not a conservative consensus on health care. And well, rather than driving a consensus, we didn't take advantage of it. If we had, we could have put that on the floor, you know, day one for Donald Trump, and I think you would have had a different trajectory.
You know that the Affordable Care Act, the precepts of it, the exchanges and so on, those were once conservative ideas. Those came out of the Heritage Foundation.
Right.
This is what Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts. That was one of the sources of aggravation, because there was a sense that, well, we're applying these precepts. There were people in the Senate, Republicans, who actually offered something quite similar to the Affordable Care Act as an alternative to Hillary Clinton's health care proposal in 1993 and 4. Who then said, well, I can't be for that now.
Right.
So that was frustrating. But it's an interesting point on the infrastructure thing. I one of the reasons, I mean, there were several reasons that the tax cuts were in the Recovery Act. One was the sense that people were getting slammed. And it was an important, you know, what really was going to ail the economy was lack of consumer activity, and you know, people just didn't have the money and were worried about spending money and so on. But the other thought was, well, Republicans,
these guys like cutting taxes.
Right.
Right. I get it. We do like cutting taxes. And
maybe to a fault.
I don't know. I think you and I talked offline about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And your criticism—that's
the $1.5 trillion you guys passed.
Well, right, and so that's the point that you ultimately made. And I think that the you take on debt, when it's a fair criticism to say we took on debt, which we did, but you take on debt to get something that is increasing in value, and
it's
you
not,
get
all. My point was you know, Republicans like to moralize about deficits when Democratic presidents are in office. When Republican presidents are in office, they like to cut taxes, and we saw it in the 80s, we saw it in the 2000s, and now we're seeing it again. You know, you guys worship at the altar of dynamic scoring this notion that somehow the stimulation that tax cuts provide will end up paying for them. And there isn't really that is an experiment that has been tried and tried and tried, and we keep ending up in the same place, which where we are right now with a $1.3 trillion deficit, you know, that's more than twice or where we were when we started this two years ago. So I actually believe I'm not as alarmed about deficits as you guys seasonally are alarmed about deficits, but I because I do believe there are investments that should be made. I think it was tragic that we didn't make more investments in infrastructure during the 8 years that Obama was president. He came each year with an infrastructure proposal. I think this country desperately needs a massive infrastructure program because we are not a 21st century. Our competitor countries are investing massively in infrastructure. We're not. There are going to be economic. There's an economic toll to that. I think there are investments in human infrastructure that go to education and training that are going to have that would have huge implications. Those are, you know, so what I object to is the notion that tax cuts are stimulative, but investments in infrastructure, investments in human capital are not. And so I'm just looking for consistency.
Yeah, I understand part of the criticism, and I accept part of the criticism, and I would defend myself against part of the criticism, too. So there is an inconsistency that you've pointed out on the Republican side as it relates to these debt questions. And that's a fair point. I think the larger point that I've made is that the taking on of debt in this time was to get a tax code that was desperately in need of updating. And the proof is, I mean, it's working. And the stimulative nature, we have an economy. We were told by any number of economists for a long time that 2% growth was the new normal. We've learned, hey, you change the regulatory scheme, you change the tax structure and realign incentives and get the capital flows coming back in, and you get real growth.
Let me just say, the question is whether that is a sugar high or whether it's real, because now we're drifting back into much less robust GDP.
Well, I think that this is the buzzkill of the trade debate. That's where I would put that as a very significant thing. But look, I think there's no question that our infrastructure is waning, and this is an area that should be a bipartisan area. It should be, there's a level of consensus. Here's the big challenge. It is very easy for us to come up with, everybody likes to spend the money, but where we come up with the money is an interesting challenge. So you got a couple of choices. You can tax carbon, which is controversial. You can tax gas, which is controversial. You can tax mileage, which is controversial, not just from the ag community, but from the civil libertarians. Or you can toll things. Now, coming from a constituency that has more toll highways in the area that I'm from than nearly any other area in the country, you know, my attitude is, hey, toll Memphis, Tennessee, toll all these places. And we're paying through the nose in terms of Chicagoland paying for our highways. But I think that there is an opportunity as it relates to infrastructure. Quickly on dynamic versus static scoring. So, and now this is just so wonky, it's ridiculous, but you provoked me and you drew me into this. So dynamic scoring presumes a change in activity as a result of a change in policy. Static scoring says you can change any policy and there's no change in activity. Now, I'm persuaded by dynamic scoring. Your criticism is, hey, you guys sprinkle this stuff out like pixie dust. And I think that if you go, for example, to the Tax Foundation, who does good work, I mean, they're center right, but they're doing robust work. They will tell you that all tax cuts don't pay for themselves and that some of them are stimulative. Getting rates down is stimulative, and full expensing, the ability of small manufacturers or of manufacturers to write things off and capitalize on them immediately, is hugely stimulative. But just a tax cut for the sake of a tax cut doesn't have the same stimulative effect.
So why don't we dynamically score investments in early childhood education?
We do. We do in some cases. In the Congressional Budget Office, for example, when they were doing the a discussion of the big immigration package, they part of what they did was they said, if you go the route, if you update, you know, as the big comprehensive immigration reform program, they made a dynamic argument within that, saying this is the amount of activity that comes from these immigrants being normalized
So forth. I think most economists would say if we don't have a steady flow of immigrants, we're going to pay a huge economic price for that. The notion of
for real of
cutting immigration is an economic death knell for this country. We're an aging country.
That's right.
We need this infusion.
That's right.
Of energy.
And you got other countries. You got Japan that's basically in a demographic death spiral. That's a very strong. But a couple generations, they have nothing but trouble ahead of them. And we don't have to live like that. We can figure out, we've got the advantage of this big immigration.
So what about
approach.
This nativist kind of sentiment in your party? That couldn't have been helpful to you.
No.
I know, helpful to you and your
re-election. It's not helpful. Look, I've come to the opinion that if you break this down, you can actually get to a good result. And I have an independent recollection of being on a conference call with a bunch of Chicago business leaders. I'm on my cell phone. I'm driving out of O'Hare Airport, and this is I'm in the leadership team with John Boehner, and these guys are very unhappy with me that we're not getting the big immigration bill done. Peter, you've got to help Boehner
because they
get
want
this done.
These H-1B
for real.
They want high end, visas, so
and they want guest
them.
Worker. They right. want. I mean, they do want it all, and they do want the people who are here with no documentation to be normalized in some way. And I said to them, you got to break this down. And start with a secure border, not a wall. The wall wasn't even a thing then, but secure the border. And then what happens? The drama drops out of the discussion, just precipitously it drops. And I've seen this in the polling. I've seen it in the focus groups, that people can actually hear the next part of a conversation if they're convinced that the border is secure. Then take the next step and then say, all right, let's go to high-skilled visas. The drama drops even further. Go to guest worker, the drama drops even further, and then say, all right, what do you want to do with 12 million people?
See, but Peter, here's the problem, and it is lack of trust, especially when you have the president sort of characterizing immigrants the way he's characterized them, you know, in a grossly unfair way. There is no trust that if you take these first steps, this notion that Democrats don't care about the border is just frankly, you know, I can't speak for every Democrat, but I can certainly, most Democrats I know think, yeah, we have to have borders. They have to be enforced. There are smart ways to do it, you know, and they don't really view the wall as, I mean, there are barriers that are needed
right.
in some places, but not, there is just no belief that if you do this thing that you're going to get there. They may go ahead and do it, but I mean, isn't a comprehensive where everybody sort of locks hands and takes the leap at once? Isn't this exactly what you were talking about?
No, it's exactly what I'm not talking about. So if the comprehensive approach was so great, it would have worked, because we've basically been having some version of discussion for the past 30 years.
Well, the Senate passed the bill in 2013. You were there.
Right.
67 votes, Republicans and Democrats didn't get a vote in the House.
Right. And I'm telling you, the better pathway here is to take it one step at a time.
But it would have passed in the House.
Maybe.
It would have passed in the House, Peter. If it wasn't going to pass in the House, Boehner probably would have put it on the floor. I mean, it didn't. The reason it wasn't on the floor was because everyone knew, with the number of Democrats and Republicans who were not locked in this sort of nativist camp, the bill had the votes to pass.
Look, some of the smartest voices out there, one of the smartest voices is Mario Diaz-Balart from Florida, one of the guys who has been in the trenches on this issue. He has put together over the years various interlocking pieces of legislation. So, for example, there's secure border funding that then triggers and moves into guest worker, that triggers then moves into H-1B. So it takes care, it moves through in a non-shocking, overwhelming way, and it moves through and it has that level of accountability that you've raised as an issue. And I think that that's ultimately going to be our remedy.
Do you think that there'll be... that the big issues facing immigration, including the 12 million, who I probably 11 million now, but because people are actually going back mm-hmm. to Mexico, not coming mm-hmm. this way. But do you think that these issues can be resolved?
I think they can be resolved. I mean, look, we've talked about Donald Trump a little bit in that, you know, he's he's a controversial figure.
He would insist that we talk about him.
There you go. You know, he's a controversial figure who in some ways creates opposition just by him being for something. And so I ran into this on the Ways and Means Committee, where I went to some of the Democrats on the committee and said, can we work together with you on tax reform? Because a bipartisan deal would have been better based on this whole argument that I'm making for the past couple of minutes. And they said, Peter, look, if Donald Trump is for this bill, I've got to be against it. That's my politics. So we're in this sort of, we're in this environment that is Trump presidency that I would argue makes it particularly challenging. But be that as it may, look at the deal that he was, you know, that he put on the table in terms of the DACA students several months ago or last year, where it was basically, I'll see your 750,000 and I'll raise you 1.5 million. And some of the Democrats on Capitol Hill was like, and this is me saying this.
Yeah.
We can't let Donald Trump have a win on immigration. That would be
Democrats offering $25 billion for the wall in exchange for dealing with the DACA. And the president seemed interested in that and got pulled back. I mean, here's the reality, okay? And tell me where I'm wrong here. You have a very, very vociferous base in that Freedom Caucus, and they have outsized influence over the caucus. It's what drove Boehner out. It's what drove Ryan out. And it makes it very difficult for all of his chest thumping, Trump is very sensitive to that base. And so when the base gets unhappy, we saw it this last, you guys, and you were there for that vote, you know, you guys were prepared to avoid a shutdown. He appeared to be willing to avoid a shutdown. And then there was a shutdown.
Right.
Why? Because the folks on the right beat their breasts, the folks on, you know, infotainment
right.
television beat their breasts and radio. This is a problem.
It is a problem. And I acknowledge it. Full pause. I acknowledge it. And I'm not dismissing it. It is now manifesting in some ways on the left. with a very few group of people who are now defining what the left is. The freshmen that have come in, and they're not playing sort of the traditional game either. So you and I
but
don't
you know, the
celebrate.
Difference is you have a speaker, for example, who on impeachment the other day said, "I don't think this is the right path." And is getting beaten up by some of her own
so she
people
did.
For it.
I commend Speaker Pelosi for that. I commend her for making sure she stood up as a co-equal branch when it came time to State of the Union and so forth. I criticize her on blinking on Representative Omar and this problem in terms of anti-Semitism and the equivocation and so forth. So she's handled a couple things well. She's only one vis-a-vis her base.
She blinked and she got rolled. She is much more in command of her own caucus than. And I'm not. I think Boehner and Ryan had very, very difficult hands to play.
The DNA of our two parties is completely different. The DNA of the Republican Party is suspicious of power, entrepreneurial. We're not joiners and all of that. The DNA of Democrats is very collective. I mean, it's
what Will Rogers said, I don't belong to any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. So there's something of that. Listen, man, I could talk to you for hours.
I've enjoyed this.
And I really appreciate you we disagree on a lot of stuff. But
we agree on a lot of stuff.
Your willingness to be open and it was hugely important for these young people here. And I should point out there was a young guy who sat in some of your seminars who actually was the field director for your opponent when you were
defeated
last fall. But the fact that he was in that room.
Yeah,
I think was really, really positive. And the fact that you didn't slug him, I think, was also positive. So, Peter Roskam, great
Thank
to be
you,
with
David.
You.
Great to be here.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit axefilespodcast.com and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.